I think I know most of you. Those that I do not know, I'm Michael. I'm a resident here at Jokoji. And I want to thank the Sangha for asking me to give the talk today, the Way Seeking Mind talk. So this talk is a narrative of how I came to this present moment, literally sitting on the cushion in this moment, and more broadly to Zen practice. I was quoted in the blurb for this talk as, quote, "Zen has colorfully and seamlessly sewn together the fabric of my entire spiritual and philosophical journey." Wow, okay. I'll do the best to elaborate on that in the course of the talk. It might seem natural to begin this sort of talk in the past and then come to the present, but I think I'd like to move from the present back into the past. I think there's a particular kind of illumination that happens in that movement from the present into the present illuminating the past. And one of my favorite philosophers in the 19th century, Soren Kierkegaard, said, although life is lived forwards, it's understood backwards. So I think that's quite fitting. So if I begin with the present moment, I sit, and this sitting is for me an expression of my total life situation. In fact, it's not merely an expression, but for me a celebration of this total life situation, both inwardly and outwardly, a deep acceptance of life as it is, whether it manifests as unpleasant experience or pleasant experience, and even the consciousness of the mind's ongoing rejection of everything I just said, all of that is encompassed in this present moment for me. And so how did I get to this present moment? Well, in a sense, I never did. It's always been present, though formally I came into this practice, and there's a particular narrative which we'll be exploring in that. I have a deep sense that what is present with me now, formally in the practice, has been always part of my experience. And so I titled this talk, "I'm Always Sitting." Many sittings, one sitting, and that's what I'd like to explore. In this journey, by the way, back into the past from the present, I promise only to cover this life. I don't remember the details of the former life, and quite frankly, I know a lot of us want to eat lunch in 40 minutes, so we'll make do with this present life. I started attending Jokoji in early 2014. I wanted to cultivate a deeper sense of awareness, deeper awareness of my inner and outer life, as well as develop compassion to a greater degree than I found in my life at that time. This interest was rooted in an increasing destabilizing of my relationship with my now former fiancé of 3 years. And that was a major interest, and this will be an important theme, actually, in my story, that for me, personal relationships have always been a gateway to exploring my inner life. Zen practice, as I started sitting, actually supplemented and reinforced work that I was doing on myself through internal family systems therapy, which is a modality in psychotherapy, which I think fits very well with Buddhism in general and Zen in particular. The combined effect of this IFS and also Zen practice earlier in the year really gave me a deep clarity that sort of resulted from peeling away all these different layers of a personal story that I had created over many, many years in my life, and it was seen increasingly to be more fiction than fact, this personal story. And being very passionate about wanting to pursue this practice, I made plans to spend the summer at Chikoji for this deeper penetration into Zen practice, my personal healing, and also writing. As it turned out, not a lot of the latter happened, but a lot of the former did, the Zen practice and the healing. The relationship with my former fiance actually ended very abruptly and dramatically in April, around the time of my birthday. And shortly thereafter, I moved into Jikoji and began what has turned out actually to be a very profound new chapter in my life. And I want to actually acknowledge brothers and sisters here in the Sangha for your very powerful influence and acceptance of me. I just want to acknowledge that. That was actually a very important moment, I think, in my presence at Jikoji. What has emerged in my experience since coming here is really a very deep sense of just sitting to sit. I know that's the motto, but to experience that personally as the reality for one's life is, I think, a very profound sort of experience. The sitting, as I've said, for me expresses my total life situation. There's nothing that is needed to be realized other than what is present, no longer waiting for anything, just being with everything as it is. And yes, the mind does want to form expectations and intentions and goals, and I just be with that too. I mean, it's very much what's encompassed by this being with whatever is happening, whatever is arising in my mind. This Jikoji sitting actually arose from an earlier sitting. As we go back in time, my Advaita Vedanta sitting. So Advaita Vedanta, for those of you unacquainted with this Hindu tradition, is one of the six darshanas of India, ways of seeing, the one that's most well-known along with yoga in the West, and it's essentially a philosophy of non-duality, Advaita, not to Vedanta, end of the Vedas. So it's the culmination of all knowledge in the realization that the multiplicity of objects in our experience are, in fact, diverse manifestations of one underlying reality. I am a pure awareness. And so there's a very interesting fit that I experienced that I think made the transition a very natural one from being involved with the practice of meditation in Advaita Vedanta and the movement into Zen. The teachers in the year before I came to Jikoji that had a pretty powerful influence on me in the direction of Advaita, although I had taught it for many years as a in my profession as a college professor. I really connected with a lot of contemporary teachers, Rupert Spira, Francis Lucille, Jeff Foster, the so-called non-duality teachers, and from them I was led into exploration of Ramana Maharshi and Sri Nisargadatta Maharaj as important teachers in the 20th century in India. And at this time, I was sitting really to see the impermanence of the body-mind. That was there's much emphasis on that in Advaita, realizing that I'm not this, I'm not that, as the saying of the Upanishads, neti neti. And in that exploration of, as it were, seeing that I'm not this body-mind, rather seeing that I am that element that is continuous through the changing thoughts, feelings, and sensations, the realization that I am, as it's often called, this abiding presence of awareness, really within which all these other things are arising. And that was really the focus of the meditation practice, was coming into this realization of how impermanent everything around me is. And that this self-conception that exerts so much of its influence in my experience is ultimately just a thought. I should say that my attraction to Advaita was partially theoretical. As a philosopher, I thought it provided really the most inclusivist, pluralistic view of comparative religion, and that was a very attractive element, giving my own intuition about the nature of religious phenomena as being fundamentally unified, but just diverse expressions filtered through our personal stories. So Advaita had a theoretical appeal to me, but it also had an experiential appeal that I think was more powerful. In 2013, I was really seeing more and more that the personal conflicts in my life, in particular in my relationship with my fiance, were really originating from an attachment to this personal story that I was carrying with me, from this belief and subsequent feeling that I am the separate self. And I think what I really saw was the subtle nature of attachment in my interpersonal sphere of life. I was, despite thinking I wasn't, I was very much seeking to find completion in something outside myself. And thus, as I think often is the case, love becomes this anxiety-ridden game of taking rather than the joy of giving. And that really struck me powerfully a year ago. And the practice of Advaita, as I've just described it, actually helped me see that. And a lot of things have started melting away in my experience. And what's fascinating about this is this movement into this deeper sort of deeper penetration into non-duality, going beneath the layers of what's happening in the mind and finding these sort of deeper strata. This actually came out of my earlier sitting, now moving back from Advaita. That non-duality sitting, we want to call it that, actually arose out of a very passionate commitment to the bhakti traditions of India, in particular Vaishnavism. So I made a transition from Indian devotional religion into what I would describe as a particular understanding, appropriation, or transformation of devotion, in my case, to Krishna as the Supreme Being. And so I want to say a few things about that movement for me. It was actually between 2009-2010, how I describe it, sort of Krishna captured my heart, largely in the context of teaching the Bhagavad Gita, which I had been teaching for a number of years. And there was this increasing draw to this particular sacred text, which I had been teaching, you know, as I said, for a couple of years even before this. And so why was this text so compelling to me? And because I think it illuminates a lot about what was happening in my experience at that time. I think it was compelling because it illuminated what I already knew was going on. That is to say, it illuminated what I already knew was true, but in shining a particular light on my known experience, it helped me at that time deconstruct a very powerful personal story that was in place. Because at that time, many years ago, my life was pretty much a train wreck. And as painful as my more recent experiences have been in the relationship domain, this was considerably more challenging at a certain level. I mean, I was physically very ill. And what I think the text offered me in my exploration was a form of love, really, that was missing from my life. This is what Krishna offered me very experientially in the reading of this text. And so I was sitting a lot in my jetted tub, actually, reading the Bhagavad Gita. In fact, my students at the time would make jokes about it because I would post on Facebook, I'm sitting in the jetted tub again. This was my nightly routine. I mean, it was a practice after teaching all day to get into the jetted tub with the Bhagavad Gita, which became very damp and wrinkled and with ink from my notes bleeding all over the page. But in that sitting, there was this really powerful connection that I was finding. And again, the kind of attachments that were very powerful in my life at that point. I was married at that point in a very toxic marriage. Things were just falling away, but in a good way rather than falling apart. I was starting to get clarity about what was happening. But it really wasn't until a couple of years into this that it really, the decisive moment, you know, we talk about these moments where there's this, something happens, right? And wow, people call this an awakening experience. And for me, it was in March of 2011 when I lost control of my truck while I was going 65 miles an hour, and I crashed head on into a huge steel construction road sign that totaled my truck. And this was really a decisive moment for me. That impact. I don't remember a lot about the actual incident, but I was told by the paramedics who happened to be there to see it happen that I was lucky that I was alive. And I walked away with minor injuries, and through even a greater miracle, my then 5-year-old son who was with me sustained not a scratch. The paramedics thought this was nothing short of miraculous, given the nature of the accident. I remember sitting on the side of the road while the paramedics were attending to me, and my son was telling me how this reminded him of a Disneyland ride. You know, except for the shattering glass part of it. He thought it was very much like a Disneyland ride. I remember sitting, and my attention became fixed on the dirt on the side of the road. I just noticed it. And I was really struck with the fact that I was seeing it for the first time. You know, and I know lots of, and this is a common experience, and that's kind of my version of it. I was sitting there, and I just noticed the dirt, and in that very moment of noticing kind of these sparkles coming up from the dirt, I had this profound sense of gratitude for being alive. That my seeing this dirt, when not calling, you know, giving it any name or anything like that, but just seeing it, and the fact that I was breathing, right? Because there was breath there in that moment, and there was an acknowledgement, a very deep acknowledgement of how much gratitude that I have, and however horrible my last 7 years had been in this relationship, that everything would be different now, that this was a very transformative experience. Quite symbolically, it turned out that my truck, when the dust and glass settled, was facing the opposite direction. A number of people have told me that was very symbolic, given that after this accident, there was a very sudden change in my whole life. I actually made the decision to leave the relationship I was in. I changed everything I was eating because I was severely overweight and in poor health, and taking a variety of prescription medications, which I flushed down the toilet. Because I just saw so clearly that this was not me, you know, none of this was me. My health improved, both physical and mental health improved. and I embarked upon a period of really wonderful exploration. In a certain sense, I felt like I came back to myself. And I felt like something had been lost in the 7 years. I kind of came back to something that has always been there, but it was also very new. It was a very new experience for me. By the end of that year, 2011, as a result of what was happening, I had embraced this bhakti Vaishnav tradition more thoroughly and sat with a guru at a Vaishnav ashram in the Mendocino Mountains, Swami Tripurari, who was a student of A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. And so I sort of immersed myself in the this particular tradition. And it was really about this experience of a profound love that I began to experience in everything around me. You know, everything around me, it was seen differently. In particular, the passage from the Bhagavad Gita that I kept coming back to, or that kept sort of rising up in my experience, was from chapter 10 of the Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna tells the warrior Arjuna, after being asked in what form should he focus his mind on in the devotion to Krishna, and Krishna says, well, you know, I am everything, infinite are the forms in which I appear. But I'll tell you a few of them. I am the mountains, Arjuna. I am the ocean, right? I am the fragrance in the air. I'm all. And it's every aspect of our experience is radiating with the divine. And the thing is, I knew that. I experienced that. And the text, as it were, reminded me of what was already happening in my experience. But this devotional experience of sitting, chanting in that case, chanting Hare Krishna and engaging in the bhakti practice, that wasn't my first experience of bhakti. I had actually been a Christian for over 20 years, and that was the prior place of seeing and practice prior to this bhakti sitting, Christian sitting. I had been a Christian for most of my adult life. In fact, was in my academic life, had written a lot on Christian philosophy, worked with very prominent Christian philosophers, so why leave that behind? Well, it's not really left behind, as I see it. It was kind of transformed in a new way. You know, I went public with this conversion, as for lack of a better term, to Vaishnavism. I went public in 2012, but, you know, I mean, this had been going on for a number of years before that. And the way I describe it is... for me, these ways of seeing and connection with a particular spiritual or religious tradition really represent a response of the whole person to the totality of the experience. And it's very hard to say why, what's the explanation for why you moved away from Christianity and went to this Indian religion. You know, I received a lot of criticism from my Christian friends. And I gave reasons for why I made the movement. Some of it was theoretical in nature. Some of it was experiential. I think for the most part, it was experiential. It just was the form of Christianity that I had immersed myself in. It just melted away. There's no particular set of arguments. I mean, there are arguments. There are various... rational considerations, a lot of emotional factors as well. But for me, it was not fitting with the totality of my experience as I became sensitive to it. And it wasn't there anymore. It didn't speak to me. It wasn't relevant. God was, though. God was relevant. It's just this particular story, had ended its sort of place in my life. As I look back on what turned out to be a very long period of time in Christian practice, and in particular for me, it was a very conservative form of Protestantism called Calvinism. Some of you may be familiar with that historic Protestant tradition. It became less and less of a connection with my life. So how did I come into that? Where, how does one move into a tradition and then it melts away? Well, this actually began also with sitting. There was sitting that brought me to Christianity. It was shortly out of high school, and I was sitting on the roof of my parents' house, as I often did. I'd sit up there with tea, which I still drink to this day, so there are certain continuities in my experience. This is chai, but I normally prefer Earl Grey, for those of you who might be interested. I love Earl Grey. So I used to sit on the roof of my parents' house and play my guitar, and I was working with a lot of destabilized elements, I think, in my teenage years that were a carryover from my childhood. And at this time, I was seeking an identity like all teenagers, but I think the particular form that it took for me had a lot to do with the background experience of difficult, I think even traumatic childhood experiences really intensified this wanting to be connected to something because I had been disconnected. Right. And I remember struggling with the sense of incompleteness and alienation. Yes, at a certain level, it's just that, you know, the angst of being a teenager, but it was part of what was happening with this whole backstory that had brought me there. And I started reading the Bible, not that this was introduced to me by my family. They never pushed religion on me. But I had had an early influence from my grandparents, my grandmother in particular, and she gave me my first Bible when I was a child, and it was sitting there on my my bookshelf for many, many years. And so at this time, I've been playing in a heavy metal band, and I was kind of afraid to, like, read the Bible because on the front cover, Jesus had short hair, and I didn't like that, you know, because I had really long hair, you know. But I started reading it nonetheless, and there was a connection happening with what was said, in particular in the Gospel according to John. I was very much connecting with a sense of presence in my life. And I was sitting on the roof of my parents' house, and just in this moment, in the middle of the night, staring up at the starry night sky, I had this religious experience. And in this experience, I just was struck with how small and significant I was. And it was a very typical so-called experience of contingency. God seemed really far away. And then, in a flash, I mean, there was no effort here in this moment, God was suddenly present to me. And the way I would describe the most important feature of this experience was I was connected, and I was connected because I was seen by the other. And I was understood, and I think this met a very fundamental need in my experience at that time. And there's a sitting that even preceded this, which I know we're running short on time, so I'd been, in my teenage years, very interested in the occult and the supernatural and mystery. And so I used to sit a lot with my friends. We would sit in the dark, actually, and try to contact spirits. And that actually grew out of my childhood. When in the middle of the night in my parents' house, when I was about 7, I used to get up and I would sit at the top of the staircase in the middle of the night in the dark and stare into the darkness of my parents' living room. And if I waited long enough, I had the experience of seeing that there are people sitting on the couches there. And then I recognized them. They were all family members and friends of the family that were deceased. But they saw me. I connected with them. I was seen once again. And I was seen in this darkness. I was seen. This was, I think, had a very powerful influence on me, sitting in the dark as a child, and then sitting in the dark as a teenager, sitting in the middle of the night on the roof in my parents' house. I seemed to be sitting in the dark a lot. Even in my jetted tub when I wasn't reading, the lights would be out, right, later in my life. So I wanted to just offer some concluding thoughts about all of this. You know, sitting has happened in many different ways in this journey that I've been describing. And I think in each time I was sitting in my life, there was this very much a seeking, right? Seeking to connect to something, seeking to be seen by the other. And in fact, I think one of the reasons why relationships have been quite an eye-opener for me, as traumatic and difficult as they've been, I have incredible gratitude for every relationship I've had, because they've actually been a means of penetrating into my deeper nature. And sometimes that happens, I think, when it's most difficult of all, we're pushed to the edges. And that's what I experienced in these many different relationships, which all came with some form of sitting. The difference now, I think, if I to put my finger on a difference, so much of my journey has been about being seen by the other, right? God, whether it's Jesus or Krishna. And then even in my early childhood, being seen by other human persons, it's really has not, that's kind of gone away. It's really less about being seen now than it is seeing. And I think that's what the appeal of Zen, I think, has emerged at this time in my life as sort of a culmination of just a series of movements, which I like to think of it as a dance. A dance. And now in this dance, being seen is less important than being a seer. And even that's not accurate. It's not about being a seer. It's just about seeing. In that being, in that seeing, what is seen is bigger than I could ever imagine myself to be. And it's just what I described as life as it is, dharma, phenomena, truth. I was struck with a quote, because I mentioned relationship through this. John Wellwood has a wonderful book, Journey of the Heart. I don't know how many of you have read that book. I highly recommend it. It's about relationships and how relationships provide us with a wonderful opportunity to explore ourselves. And Wellwood says, our connection with someone we love is one of the best vehicles for the journey into our deeper nature. And the intimacy afforded by relationships really is what facilitates that. And that's what I've experienced in this path, in my various relationships. It's brought me really, I think, to a sense of truth that is behind this personal story that is there in all of these relationships. You know, as a philosopher, I'm often asked, you know, what is truth? You know, that's one of those popular questions. Students often ask that. And given that I've been exposed to so many different spiritual traditions, and I've had this sort of dynamic, evolving process of engagement with the sacred, the transcendent, whatever name we choose to give to it, I'd just like to close with sort of a statement that kind of summarizes my total life situation in connection with that What I say is this, that this truth, sometimes it appears as Jesus, sometimes it appears as Krishna, sometimes as the Buddha, sometimes as ghosts appearing in the middle of the night, you know. Sometimes it's just the dog laying in the shade. Sometimes it's a tear that's falling down your face. I feel I've been very lucky because it has also emerged for me as the ground upon which I walk and the ground upon which I sit in this moment. And this ground really, as I see it, is not a particular place. It's just wherever I am. And that's something that even words can't adequately convey. And so I sit here with all of you. Thank you. I don't know if we have time for any questions. 10 minutes. Sure.
So many wonderful insights. Thank you for all that. Many questions. One thing that keeps reoccurring in my mind is, and I think I agree with you, with relationships as a gateway. I think you started out to the inner life.
Mm.
After reading Jung and Anima and Anima's situation, I tend to think, I ask myself, who is this person that I'm in this relation with? And what are, because it's not just anybody.
Right.
So I thought maybe you might expand on that.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm a big fan of Jung. Mm-hmm. Indeed, a good aspect of my inner work, I'm going to use that phrase, has been the exploration of the feminine. Yeah. As I raised the question for myself that you've introduced, it's become very clear to me in my attractions to women that I now ask myself a different kind of question than I used to ask, you know, because I see in so many ways the question that I was asking before, at least the implicit assumption that was being made, was what do they have that I don't? You know, that's where the you know, complete me way of thinking arises in very subtle forms, of course. Now it's when there is attraction in some form, whatever it might be, the outer feminine, I ask, what is this telling me about something in myself that is longing to be developed? So that what is in the other is in myself, and being able to turn inward and see that this attraction is a reflection of something longing for evolution in myself, being able to turn to that and cultivate that, explore it, sit with it, actually allows the relation to the outer feminine to be one of giving rather than taking. That's so. There's a lot of correspondence here between Jung, I think, in the Eastern traditions, and also IFS therapy. So these things all converge in my experience. That's, you know, not to say it's a, you know, it's like, oh, just do that. It's far more challenging, but I think in the seeing that the mind doesn't want to go there, I think that's actually a really important part of the experience. But yeah, that's how I see it now. Thank you. Thank you. It's a frequent topic in my blogs, by the way. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Future work, or your present work, mm-hmm. You're writing a book.
Yeah.
Could you just say a few words about
that? Yeah, I'm writing a book about life after death, which I think this goes back to my childhood, sitting at the top of the staircase, staring into the dark and conversing with spirits. But I'm exploring, it's fairly technical sort of book, looking at a variety of alleged evidences for survival of death, empirical evidences, as they're often called, near-death experiences, cases of past life memories, alleged past life memories. And I'm looking in particular at some of the challenges in trying to construct an argument from these alleged facts to the conclusion that the self, or some aspect of the self, survives death. And it's a philosophical critique, actually, of the existing tradition of arguments over the last 150 years. And I sort of have what at least I'm told is a new angle on an old problem. But for me, you know, the project, although it's there's a lot of logic chopping in it and so forth, you know, I've often stood back from this professional engagement that I have, because I know that it meets a very basic impulse in myself. It's expressing itself as this sort of these logical exercises, this conceptual exploration, you know, and what is it? Well, I think it's really issues of identity, you know, the nature of the self and consciousness that have been with me actually from my childhood. I didn't mention this in the talk because of time, but I guess it's appropriate to mention it now, that one of the traumatic aspects of my childhood that really, I think, brought me into this whole narrative that I've given you today is my mother suffered from dissociative identity disorder, formerly called multiple personality disorder. And although they tried to shield me from that as much as they could, they were not fully successful. I had a number of experiences that really, I didn't have one mother. I had many mothers, you know, and not all of them were interested in the job. So that was something that really, I think really impressed upon me the interest in, you know, who am I? What am I? How do I know that the other person is as they seem to be? This whole issue of identity. And I think the interest in life after death, which is a whole sub-story in all of this, is fundamentally an expression of my own inner journey. You know, the underworld is the unconscious, you know. It's like, you know, the anima, right, the feminine that's there, that is sort of taking me into parts of the psyche that normally I'm not noticing. And I think one of the wonderful things about Zazen is that so many aspects that are exerting influence in the conscious life are given a voice, because they're allowed to speak, to be there. And that's part of that journey. So, so my present work has a depth that really goes into, I think, the dynamics in this personal story, personal connection, even though it doesn't really show itself so much in the technical aspects of the writing. It's a journey. It's just part of the journey, you know. And there's something being done in this, and I think it's largely unconscious. Yeah. Thank you.
We should call.
Yes. Thank you.